we've got one of the top boat builders in the country, probably Brian McDonald. Brian, have you anything on the history of your family and the boat building tradition?
Well, we're the sixth generation of boat builders. The McDonald family came to Greencastle area somewhere after the 1745 rebellion in Scotland and settled in Greencastle area. Were boat builders on Skye before they came here, and they developed a boat called the Drunthen boat, which originated in Norway. It was taken off Norwegian design of boats that were taken here on cargo ships in the 1800s, and it was developed to suit fishermen on the Foyle and the north coast of Ireland, basically, and the islands of Scotland, all used Drunthen boats.
Yes, they're really known far and wide, the McDonald family, from, you know, from Cape Clear to here. Yeah. Like, a McDonald boat was as renowned, like, fair play to you, you know, it's something that the whole area has to be proud of, I must say.
Well, there are very few left now in Donegal. In the mid-60s, early 70s, there was 19 boat builders in Donegal alone, and now there's, well, two, I suppose, if you count Mooney's Boatyard in Killarney. And ourselves, you can count that, that's about the whole of it. And there used to be three in the north, in Northern Ireland. There's none now.
Could we say, maybe even suggest that quality won out?
Well, I don't know.
Well, your firm must have been very, very busy, we'll say, at the turn of the 20th century, because I was sitting and chatting to an old neighbour of mine out at Ballyhillion, where I lived one day, you know, and he counted sort of from Ballyhillion just to Slieban alone, which is only, what, a mile really, 32 Drunthen boats, you know, that had fished from that area, and we're only talking about a mile, and various wee coves and shores. Like, there was 32 that he could remember.
Oh, well, there was quite a lot. In the early part, and at around the turn of the century, there was actually 2 yards in operation. My grandfather would have been had a second yard operating at a Burton Port, which built all the Drunthens down west. Granted, it was only for maybe 5 or 6 years, or maybe 10 years at the outside, anyway, as far as we know. And that was about 1905 to somewhere about 1915, or somewhere around that, in between those years. There was actually 2 yards in Moville as well. There was one in the River Owen and one in Foyle Street, where the last yard used to be there.
Well, did you build the one down in the museum then, Dunny Thames?
What idea? Yeah.
No, I would have thought that, aye. Like, who else would have built it?
Ryan, do you remember, I noticed your father had in the shed up on the wall, if the Lord had meant us to build fiberglass boats, he'd have grown plastic trees.
Very good, Jerry, very good.
Sean, you've also another story about the Spanish Armada.
Well, the Spanish Armada, as everybody knows, came into Glenegibney Bay. And the amazing thing about the Armada, and I'm not going to the story because it's fairly well known, but what I find amazing about it is that the folklore about the Armada, this dreadful event that happened with 350 people losing their lives and others being scattered around the country, and some of them being killed in Derry. The amazing thing about it is that the folklore died out completely in the Donegal area. And I'm not a seaman, and I'm a very poor person on boats, but as a student, I used to go over to the Donegal. And I used to go out with a fisherman called Hugh McConwy. He would have been born in the late 1800s. And the thing that amazed me about McConwy was that he knew the name of every rock that we sailed over. And there's one in particular at the entrance to the little harbour there at Donegal. It's called the Failiwecky. So that's just one example of his knowledge of rocks and the sea around there. But he never once talked about the Armada. And we're sailing over the Armada wreck all the time, and he'd absolutely no idea of it. What he did mention, of course, was a ship called the Mary Snow that was lured into Donegal Bay and shipwrecked. And that developed into a famous song, and it sort of cast aspersions on the people of Donegal. So there was an unwritten rule that that song was never to be sung in a pub, and if it was, the consequences would be very, very serious. In Five Finger Strand, where the Alcest is still to be seen. Every time I go out there at low tide, I'm just absolutely intrigued by the fact that this ship has lain there for well over 100 years. I can still see the structure of it, and the timber has survived. It must have been fantastic timber that they were using that has remained on that very treacherous bay all those years. And of course, there was a lot of timber on that ship when it went aground, and the timber was actually sold by auction on the beach. And of course, the obvious thing to do would be the people who buy the timber and roof their houses. So a lot of the houses around there have been roofed with timber from that particular ship. But Mary Reed and Karen told me that her grandfather bought timber, and that he used that timber to build a counter in McDonough's in Cairn. And the counter is still there, so it's a living link between the timber on the ship and the ship being still out there as well.
It's a twilight, wasn't it?
Sorry, I beg your pardon, twilight.
The twilight, that's right. That's just still there of a low tide. Oh, she hasn't moved now for a brave while, all right. That might explain why now there was a man in Malin Head who couldn't understand when he went to check the roof timbers of his own house, and it was a pretty old house that was solid oak timbers, you know. And he was actually, we were talking about it one night in a pub, and he mentioned that this was amazed him, pure solid oak timbers. That could be the explanation. So the next day I'm talking to him, I must tell him.
With another cavernier here, Jim, have you anything you'd like to say about the area and boating and things?
I'm just a retired fisherman, fished since full time since 1970 up until 2005. I owned four different boats during the period at different times.
Did it take you far away from Greencastle?
No, mostly up Stanton Bank would have been the farthest from that up to Duarte, mostly the northwest coast. Fished for a while in the east coast, fished in Killybegs, mostly inshore fishing. Give it up for a bad job.
Well, John, would you then have the same opinion, or would you disagree totally with me that when we were trying to get into the EEC, we sold away our whole heritage? You know, we were sitting on top of like Texas and the oilers. We were like that with the fishing, except it was sold away. The negotiators gave the whole thing away. Now, that's my opinion now, but maybe...
With hindsight, that'll be everybody's opinion, but the reality of the thing was that when we went into Europe, that the fishing was very underdeveloped in Ireland. In my mind, any bit of prosperity was in the country came since that.
Yeah, well, what I mean also was simply had to pay a bit more attention to developing the fishing. For some reason, is it because there was no votes on it or what, that the fishing always came a poor, poor last in Ireland when it came to any sort of investing of money? You know, there was never the same, or was it because the fishermen didn't have a great shout, you know?
The fishermen say now that the EU destroyed it, but in my mind, fishermen themselves destroyed it.
Well, we know they didn't do it a lot of good in times, but I had a conversation with a man not that long ago, and he was talking about, it was a man that had a naval officer, he had boarded a Frenchman 200 miles west of Shannon. Now his hands are tied, like, you know, and he found 18 ton of hake on the Frenchman, which was perfectly legal, and there would have been at that time £4,000 a ton. Yeah. An Irish boat going into the same box was only allowed to catch 1 ton of hake. But it hardly paid for the diesel to leave, say, Castletown to go there, you know. And like, this man was furious, but his hands were tied, the Frenchman was legal. You know, so there has to be something badly wrong there, where, you know, a Frenchman can have 18 times what an Irishman could catch in the same place.
But basically what happened is Ireland did not have any track record of fishing in them areas when we went into Europe. And the French and the Spanish had, and they still have. That's how that came to be.
That would make a fair bit of sense.
Yeah, that's what happened.
I remember 1960s, we used to get Spanish sailors used to come in here. They worked in pairs, mostly the hake they were after. They weren't big boats, they were 80 feet wooden boats, mostly out of North Spain, San Sebastian and around there. They usually came in with a wire and a screw because they were pair trawling.
Oh, aye.
And they'd come in here to get the wire out of the propeller. They'd put them alongside the pier in Maville, the diver would come down. But I remember there was maybe about one or two 50-footers in Mavilla that in Greencastle at the time. And this skipper says, "You Irish are mad," he said. "We steam 1,000 miles to fish off your coast and we make plenty of money and you people are not bothered about it."
maybe we do have ourselves to blame, you know. You know, I always took the very simplistic view that we were sold out, but no, that's a fair point.
I just love bringing it back to the water world of the foil again, you know. Not everybody realises that the border is actually on the water. But the border, this is for the Republic of Ireland to the UK. And it's not that far out. You know, if you imagine the channel as it goes up, you know, the shipping channel comes all the way up the foil towards Derry. You know, that the channel, I think, is in the UK. And even the piers, and one pier in particular, in Mobile, but the very presence that the border was there and it wasn't on the other side of the foil basin, you can imagine it just made life an awful lot simpler for the UK during the Second World War, having lost the Swilly just the year before the war started in 1938. They're faced with another world war, but then they still had the foil. That waterway out there, that has seen everything. Every available type of ship has come down that foil. You know, from our first settlers to the Vikings to the Normans, English, two or three times, you know, and right to the Second World War. Now, I would have loved to see the sight of the German submarines being surrendered and then sailing past here, going into surrendered Lissahalli and Derry.
But you're dead right there, Desi, about the ships from the Vikings all the way through to modern...
Oh, even before that, the Celts, apparently, the Celts, we are apparently the descendants of, came down the foil, and in the foil river, round about Lifford. Do you read that as well, Desi? And Brian Lacey has a book on that period, and he said that whole area is chock-a-block with early Celtic habitation and artefacts. That's the Celts of Ireland, yes, came in that way.
Brian Lacey just draws your attention to the fact that the earliest settlements of that period are in view of the foil. You know, as if to see, they want to see where they came from, you know. But since you're going back in leaps and bounds, the earliest manuscripts and the earliest mention of the foil, it's nice to go back and then start working forward rather than what we're doing here, we keep drifting back. In the earliest texts written from older oral tradition gives the rising of three great lakes in Ireland when the world was 3,000 years old. And the three great lakes were Lough Foyle, Lough Neagh and Lough Ree. That all sounds very fanciful when you say it. Oh, he's gone back to mythology. But think on global warming. Think we're coming close to a period, oral history in Ireland, 3,000 years old, and what happened 3,000 years before people ever knew about the place? An ice age melted. An ice age had come to an end. Could there possibly have been a glacier or something blocking what you know now is the mouth of the foil? There it is. I mean, the foil's not a deep water. The average depth of the foil, the average over the whole Lough Foil area, it's only 5 feet.
Just speaking about the lakes, Desi, reminds me of a little story from one of Percival Swan's books called Romantic Inishowen. Percival Swan was a historian from Buncrana, and I believe there's some moves on now to get some of his artefacts back into the county again. However, in the book Romantic Inishowen, he has a little bit of folklore regarding the foil. And he calls it the Enchanted Lake. It's when you mention lakes that he reminds me of it. And apparently many, many, many years ago, there was two ladies. One lived in Connemara, the other lived up here in Inishowen. And there was no such thing as a foil at that time. It was just a piece of arid ground. So the lady up here sent a messenger down to her sister in Connemara. And she asked her, she said, would you give me the loan of one of your silver lakes? Because we have no lakes up here. And the sister down in Connemara, being very good-natured, she wrapped the lake up in a white sheet. And she dispatched it over the hills and the dales to Inishowen. her sister had said that she would return it on Monday. However, the lake remained year after year, and the sister in Connemara was waiting for the lake to be returned. She got fed up waiting, and she eventually sent a messenger to collect it. And the sister up here said, I did in fact say I would return it on Monday. That is also Gialluin, the Lord's Day. So it will remain here until the coming of our Lord. So the foil remains until this day, while there is a big, big hole down in Connemara waiting for the waters that never returned.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Funding Scheme, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland initiative.